You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Chip Massey, who is a former FBI hostage negotiator and special agent who led high-profile cases, spearheaded the New York FBI's office crisis negotiations teams, and won the prestigious FBI Director's Award. He is co-founder of The Convincing Company, a crisis communications and training firm. He's written a new book with his company's co-founder, Adele Gambardella, called Convince Me, High-Stakes Negotiation Tactics to Get Results in Any Business Situation. Enjoy the pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Chip Massey, welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure to be here, Kelly. Thank you.
So, we briefly chatted before we started, but and this podcast is probably going to air. It's definitely going to air after I get back from this. But I just booked a trip to Quantico to the FBI education group around hostage negotiation. You have written an entire book about this. I'll just ask you this. Why do you think they invited folks from Second City down?
Well, Kelly, this is, I want to encourage all your listeners, and of course they have, but if they have not, get into Kelly's material, get into what he and his wife are doing. You know, here's the thing. We are all about understanding human behavior, why we do what we do, and how we respond to each other in critical moments. So that's like, crisis, that's like, you know, whatever for you is a huge event. So they asked you because of, I can guarantee you, you have very specific viewpoints that amplify what it is they teach down there. And, you know, I so appreciated the distinction that you made in, improvisation versus stand-up. And I think it's one of the things is that in improvisation, tell me if I got this wrong, is that you are building onto something that has been presented in front of you.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what a good hostage negotiator should be doing. Is the person you, what you're doing is you're trying to extract information. You are trying to pull information, but you are letting a conversation flow. Because if I am talking, like I'm doing now, if I'm talking, I'm out. It's not good. I need to be receiving from that individual. Now, that's what we try to do. We try to keep the conversation going in the most robust and revealing and emotional way we can.
So, good hostage negotiators do this. I would suggest that good doctors do this. Mm-hmm. I'd also suggest that good ministers do this.
Yeah.
So 2 out of 3, you cover.
Well done. Well done. Yes. Yes. I was a minister before I was an FBI agent. Yeah.
But that is not weird to me. That actually seems highly connected.
See, you are one of the few people because you get it. You get it. I was dealing with people in crisis every day. It was all about listening with empathy, no judgment. It was all about handling what was in front of me and getting them to they're working out through their own solution what needed to happen to be a presence of good for them.
Yeah. And that is
That's hard work.
Yeah, buddy.
The ability to shut up and not just shut up. And you and I both have a slight qualm with the term active listening.
Yeah.
I appreciate the spirit of it. It feels like that's a better version, but it's not the whole version, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So in our book, we advocate forensic listening. And that's what I'm so excited about. I mean, active listening is awesome, and it helps so many people. And, you know, when there's discord, when, you know, they're at each other's throats. And if you have the ability, that training to say, okay, you know, here's the skill set, and it will de-escalate. However, you still have more information that you have gleaned from a conversation that you can use to better deepen that relationship after it's happened. See, that's the thing, is what we say, is that forensic listening is the art and science of analyzing a conversation after it's happened, because words leave clues. That's what we say. And so what you're doing there is you're observing a person from four perspectives, and then you're building on to that, and you are going to use other techniques that we teach as a way of continuing to build that relationship, that connection, that emotion.
Yeah. When I was writing our book, Yes And, originally we were knee deep in all the philosophy, the theory, all that. and at a certain point, our publisher is like, you always tell me great stories. Where are the great stories? And that is something that certainly is in your book. And one of the early ones you talk about is interrogating a drug cartel enforcer that, for the purposes of your book, you call Marco. And you said you needed to find his unstated narrative, which is something you talk about in the book. Can you tell us about this particular case and the unstated narrative?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it was one of those things where we were investigating a rival cartel. And we knew if we had some information on how these things were working, how the insides of it, we'd be much more effective in our investigation. So, you know, we knew we had somebody that was already in federal prison, serving time. That's Marco. He had 8 bodies on him. They were able to convict him of 8 murders. So he wasn't getting out. He wasn't going to see, he saw the sun for like an hour a day.
Yeah.
So very little to do with that kind of situation. But the idea here is that they still wanted us to go to see if he would give up any information at all that might be helpful, you know, help us unlock some of these things. So we get in there, and Marco comes in, and I describe it in the book is that this guy, I mean, he's out of like Hollywood casting. I mean, he comes through and he is the embodiment of confidence, of power, of authority. His hair is perfectly combed. His jumpsuit, you know how there's a lot of times they sag and so forth. His looked like it was tailor-made and it was pressed. Mm-hmm. And this guy sits down across from us, Kelly, like we were there for his meeting, right? Mm-hmm. He was like, I hope you're not going to waste my time kind of look to him, right? So we're sitting there and I'm fumbling, you know, I'm saying, hey, look, you got some information, obviously. Here's the thing, because I'm thinking this is all barter, right? This is transactional. This is how prison works, you know. That's how they get along in there. So I'm thinking, all right, how about this? How about we give you a better cell? How about we move you across the country where you can be closer to your family? How about this? Once he sat down and I introduced myself, his eyes went up and to the right of my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they stayed through the whole conversation. It's like, I had nothing of interest for this dude. Nothing. So I'm at a loss. I mean, nothing's working. And I know I have to go back to my bosses and say, sorry, I got nothing. And that's not a happy conversation. So I'm thinking this is done. And I've got nothing left. And I'm starting to pack up reluctantly. And I'm moving as slowly as I can. And I'm thinking, all right, when we did the research on this guy, the way he moved about in his organization, the way every kill he made, it advanced that cartel. They grew in their monies. They grew in their territory. They grew in their respect in the area. They just became, you know, so much more efficient, and just the reputation was huge. So I'm thinking, all right, let me just throw this out. I said, you know, Marco, listen, this is obviously a big waste of time. I said, but I got to tell you, as I researched your case and went through your files, the way you moved, and that's what I told him. I said, everything that you did improved that organization. And I know from a business perspective, what you did was remarkable. So why I can't condone anything that you did from a purely business perspective, I have to say respect. And I got up to go. And that's when this guy says, sit down, ask me your questions. I'm like, what? And it became apparent because, Kelly, we gave this guy nothing.
Yeah.
We didn't help him with a cell. We didn't get him his family closer. We didn't give him any money, nothing. And what it became apparent was this guy's unstated narrative was he wanted to be seen as a business expert, a strategist. That's what his thing, you know, he was done being like, he already had the tough guy done. What he wanted to be seen throughout that system was, hey, the FBI is coming to me as a consultant. And they see me as somebody that is a value in this respect. And it changed the dynamic entirely. So that was the unlock. That was his unstated narrative. I want to be seen as this business strategist. Like, and that's what I lucked upon and got it to him.
So this is directly connected to William Swan's work around self-verification theory. This idea that we want to be seen as we see ourselves.
Come on.
We're never going to tell someone what that is because we don't even, it's in our bones as opposed to our conscious thoughts. And this is what I talk about all the time is we both work in and have worked in fields where listening is usually important, but until I got equipped with sort of the science of understanding all the different modes of listening, I was only maybe halfway there. And so when I got exposed to Swan's stuff, I'm like, oh, okay. I either need to ask different questions. I need to do a different kind of prep work, which is all what you were talking about to get to the point of how does this person really see themselves? I mean, it also explains why the joke I make is it explains why people get into terrible relationships. Because sometimes they don't see themselves well. And when someone scratches that itch is being scratched.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Yes. There's another story I'd love you to talk about. And that's when you were paired with a U.S. Marshal to run down leads on the whereabouts of several fugitives. So you ended up doing the lead interview, right? This guy handed it off to you?
Yeah, it was a terrifying moment for me, Kelly. I was on a fugitive apprehension team, and it was one of those deals where the Bureau brings in everybody to be a part of his task force. So every acronym is there, right? You've got everybody. I, fortunately, for my stint there, I got paired with U.S. Marshal Justin Vickers. A great guy, by the way. I'm still in touch with him. He's marvelous. And he had all this experience. I was new, right? I was a rookie. And, so one day, you know, after we do a early morning team arrest, he said, all right, Chip, we're going to go track down some leads on our guy. I'm like, okay, great. So we're riding and he says, you know, it says we possibly have an address for his grandmother out here. You know, we're going to go. And he said, Chip, I'm going to ask you to take the lead on this. All right. You know what to do. You just ask the questions. I said, okay. Now I am close to terrified at this point, Kelly, because I don't want to F up in front of this U.S. Marshal. Right. And I also don't want to lose his respect and I don't want to embarrass the Bureau. Right. It's a lot of pressure here. Right. So as I go up to the door, I'm just about to knock and Kelly, he pulls me back. He goes, Chip, I just want to say one thing. He goes, you're going to do great, but I don't want you to knock like you FBI guys typically do, you know, boom, 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 FBI, right? I don't want you doing that. He says, just lightly knock. I'm like, yeah, okay. So I just barely tap that door and it flies open. Right? Mm-hmm. And there she is. It's obviously a grandmother. She's stately. She's perfectly put together. I mean, she's, you know, and you can tell this is somebody that is not used to having law enforcement at her steps.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, showtime. Here I go. And I got my clipboard and I got my questions and I'm going down. All right. We call him Jeff. When was the last time you saw Jeff? And, you know, does he have any known associates, relatives, friends that are around here? What are the jobs that he might have? What kind of car does he drive? Does he have any girlfriends? Where does he do his banking? Do you know where he might hang out? What are hobbies and interests? I went through my list, right? Exhaustively, like a good FBI agent does. And then I said, well, ma'am, so listen, if you have any more information about him, here's my card. This is Marshall Vickers. Here's his card. And I said, Marshall Vickers, any other questions? And he says, nope, that about covers it. I said, okay. All right, ma'am, thank you very much. And you have a good day. And we leave the step. He's pulling out his phone as we're walking back to his car. And I'm like, I'm feeling good a little bit, right? Because I asked all my questions. I didn't mess up there. And he's massively dialing. I mean, he's texting furiously. And I said, well, I'm sorry, it's a dry hole. It didn't work out. Where should we go next? And he says, hold up, Chip. I'm texting the team. I said, oh, why? You got to lead on something? He goes, no. He looks at me, he goes, puzzled. He's like, no, Chip, he's here. I said, say what? So no, he's all right. He goes, Chip, it's going to take a second for the team to get here. He goes, let's talk about it. He said, what did you see when that woman opened up that door? And I said, he goes, you didn't, right? Because you were paying attention to the dang questions. I'll tell you what I saw is that there was no light between her and that door frame. I said, okay. And what's that tell you? It tells you that she doesn't want you to look inside. That's one. I said, oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. He goes, all right. What else did you notice when you started asking your questions? What did you see her do? I said, I don't know, Justin. Right. You were focused on something else. He said, with every question you asked, she slowly retreated back into her house, inch by inch. I said, okay, I missed that. He goes, right. And here's the big one, Chip. You ready? He goes, well, I said, what? He goes, what didn't she ask you? I don't understand. Chip, that's his grandmother. Yeah. Why wouldn't she ask about her grandson? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't she ask about, is he okay? Is there something I can do? Yeah. It's because he's there. I said, uh-oh. He said, all right. He goes, team's here. I'm going to go up. He said, just watch. And he goes up and Kelly, you would appreciate this from, you know, TV perspective, because it was just like out of the freaking TV. So he just again glances that door, flies open. There she is. Same thing. And I'm watching everything and he's right. And he just leans in a little bit and he says to her very softly, he says, ma'am, sorry to bother you again, but I need to ask you a few more questions. Now just shake your head. Yes or no. Any first question is, he's here, right? She shakes her head, yes. Mm-hmm. He goes, and he points up. Upstairs? No. Mid-level? No. Basement? Yeah. And he asks her, does he have a gun? She says, yes. So he says, all right, ma'am, listen, for your safety and our team, please just step aside. She does. She complies. We go in. Dude's there, right? We arrest him. But if it had been up to Inspector Clouseau here, he would have gotten away, right? So yeah, I missed everything. I mean, it was exactly everything that I knew to look for. I didn't, because I was so focused on another task, right? She was telling me everything without saying it, right?
Yeah. Now I'd also say, in the spirit of good theater, good storytelling, but also in regard to how more all of us are better than one of us, almost like you needed that. You're the straight man. You need a straight man who was like, and you know, not getting it, and that allowed for that interaction and for someone to view, because we can only do so much at once. But the larger point, of course, that you're making, which is there are so many other clues coming, and in part, and this is a big thing we talk about here, which is contexts are always different.
Ooh.
If you have one playbook, that is not enough.
Yes.
You need a endless playbook with endless imaginations of things, because we just don't know all these. It's you're either the blind man on the elephant, right? or you're like, you know, messy and you can see the whole field for some freakish reason. And it's hard because we all live on a spectrum in between those things. So I'm curious for you is, did you learn that lesson in the moment and you adapted, or did it take you a while?
Oh, you know, it's one of those things I think also, Kelly, is that having reps in it is a thing, and having reps and having somebody helping you see what you're missing.
Mentorship.
Right. So you can perfect that is everything. And also the nerves, you know, those things also get settled and your vision expands, you know, and all your senses. Right. Right. It's just like when you're doing improv, when you're first starting out, I'm sure you are terrified to be up on stage and, you know, you've got brain fart all over the place.
That's
and
right.
But the more reps you put in those moments, the better off you're going to be.
You in chapter 4, which is called the exact steps to start convincing, you write, quote, most of us lead the discussion with our most strongly held position. We play our best card first. We're excited to share the epiphanies that led us to our new understanding, as if that were enough to get another person to adopt our beliefs. While reinforcing our own opinion this way is deeply satisfying to the ego, it never convinces anyone of anything, end quote. All right. I love this. Why do we not play our best hand first?
That's right. And so my co-author, Adele Gambardella, started off as a journalist. And she was kind of mortified by this. And she said, nah, that's exactly right. She goes, because she was taught, you know, you lead with your biggest point first, always in the story. That's always how you do it. Most people, most of us are designed this way. That is our instinct, right? Go for the kill. When we are dealing with an opposing viewpoint, we just want to slice and dice them and let them know how right we are. Well, we know, you know, the more years you get on you, is that there's better ways of getting there. And this is the whole idea of the convincing continuum, is that this is backed up by 40 years of social science that you already know about, Kelly. But the idea here is that you start with your latitude of acceptance, of agreement. Where is that point? And that phrase usually starts out with something like, we can all agree, dot, 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 right? Mm-hmm. That's where you begin. Now, it takes discipline to slowly move a person toward an area where you want them to be. So you go from acceptance to closer to, all right, where's the doubt? Where's the fear? Where's the uncertainty? As you move them down closer, but you stop short of crossing over into the latitude of rejection, which is your viewpoint. So like, you know, one of the examples that we use is that we believe the moon landing was made up, right? And this is, we talked to a professor at Columbia, Dr. Bontempo, who gave us this great story. And it's like, why is it that, you know, so he said, my contention is the moon landing was made up, and I have proof. So he's not going to start out there. He's going to say, you know, I think sometimes is that, you know, we all know that there are people that other countries have explored the atmosphere of the moon. And so he goes, what other countries has landed somebody on the moon? And, you know, and we ask, has any other country besides the United States landed somebody on the moon? And invariably, you know, people aren't sure, you know, they think, well, they get it confused. Like, okay. I'm like, so when you look up at the night sky, what is it that you see if you're like, there's no white noise around, there's nothing like that around? Because stars, okay. I was like, I'm curious, when you look at that picture of Neil Armstrong putting the flag on the moon, and in the background, do you see stars in that picture? And he leaves it there. Right? And he goes on to say, I'm just saying, you know, has the government ever lied to you?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, And so what we found when we do this, Kelly, in groups, is people are slyly pulling out their phones and they're looking up that moon picture, right? Mm-hmm. And there's obvious, you know, optical reason why you don't see the stars, shutter speed and all that. But what's great is that it immediately proves the point. It helps people understand. So we call that the convincing cliffhanger, is that when you give just enough information that's going to ask and incite somebody to say, I'm going to look that up for myself because I don't trust these guys. And it further embeds where you want them to go, is the idea.
I mean, the resonance of this idea, given the noise we're in right now. Right. I mean, and this happens to me when I speak, and I've been doing this for quite a few years, but right now people are going, oh my God, like this is because we are living in an age of like, what's up is down, what's down is up. And it's so confusing. And you're sort of like, well, people are using us for their own ill begotten means. And yes, of course, it's always been around. Yes, of course it wasn't, but we didn't have the kind of media in our pocket, which seems to be the biggest difference here, I guess.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, if nothing is true, if there isn't truth and it's, you can have alternate truths. I mean, what do you got? Right.
Yeah.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
In this chapter also, I don't remember ever hearing the story of Andrew Carnegie and the Eads Bridge. So this is in the late 1800s. Can you tell us about that?
Right. And that's one of Adele's favorites, is that he spent, you know, he knew that the future of this was building that steel bridge, but people were still so fearful of crossing man-made structures because the track record wasn't good. Bridges collapsed all the time under the significant weight. So he knows that he can't build a bridge that people won't cross. So how does he do that? How does he, you know, it's gonna fail if nobody uses it. So what he does is that he plays on a kind of a mythic legend understanding. And it goes like this, is that elephants are by nature know that they won't cross anything that is shaky, that won't support their weight. It's you know, the idea here is that they just have this vibe about them. They know, they sense it. So that's what he did. He had those elements cross that bridge, and that settled it. That allowed people to say, oh, this is it. You know, I can cross safely. This elephant does it. I can do it. And that's what it takes, right? That's the mind shift, is that you see it happen, you know, whatever that impossibility is. If you just understand what other people's perceptions are about it, you're going to find a way through it, to being able to convince them. Yeah.
Fascinating. It's not some P.T. Barnum stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So we, in our work, we're creating material in conversation with an audience, right? We're improvising to get to script. So we are storytelling, but we involve the audience in our story. And Mike Norton from Harvard talks about the IKEA effect, the fact that people value something, they give greater value to something they feel they had a part in making, even if that's at IKEA furniture, which is essentially all presented to them. You talk about this in the field of hostage negotiation. So talk about what that nuance is.
So value is, so for example, I never negotiated with anyone. That really, it's a misnomer. That was not my job. My job was to convince that person to value what I valued. So he starts out in saying, I want $20 million and a jet. I'm like, okay, thank you for telling me. And I'm using all the techniques, the active listening and so forth. But I know there's never going to be $20 million and a jet, right? I'm all about, how do I get those people out that he's got a gun to their head? And I've got to focus on him. So what do? I'll say, you know, I'm just curious. You said a jet. And where would you go in a jet? You know, if you could go anywhere, where would you go? I'm just curious, right? Building, you know, what I'm doing, right? And I'm going to get him to talk about that. And I'm also going to get him to talk about the feeling of being whatever that place is. And I'm going to talk about the money. I'm not going to give it to him, but I'm going to talk about it all day. And I'm going to say, with $20 million, I mean, that's so precise. What? I'm just curious. Do you have something in mind that you would spend that on besides, you know, getting over your living expenses and wherever you're going to hide out? But what would you do with the rest of it? Just, can you tell me? So what you write? And mm-hmm. then I'm moving him down. It's a slow process and things all of a sudden is like, you know, we're talking about the 20 million. I don't know if we're going to get there. You know, it's looking like, I'm starting to decrease and his view of what he's going to get. And eventually I'm going to turn the relationship over from a point of he being in complete charge to realizing I'm now the point of contact that can save his life today because his world just got really, really small. But it takes time.
And you're de-anchoring, right? You're taking away the anchor.
Yeah, and replacing it with something else.
Something else. Yeah.
Right. Exactly, Kelly. Exactly.
And you talk about this too in the book about synchrony and group activity.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we certainly know that because we work in ensembles here. Mm-hmm. But you know, and when I'm talking to, this is a thing lately I've been saying in my talks, which is, we're not going to solve our problems one person at a time. It's just too many of us. We're also not going to solve problems one institution at a time. That is there's too many different constituencies. But you know where we can solve things is one team at a time. A Ooh. Team is manageable. You know, whether it's a team of 3, 4, 5, 6, probably up to about 10, 12, that sort of thing. And it strikes me that in your work, certainly with the FBI, it is about, okay, this is now a team. We're a team. We're a group. So it's not you and an enemy. It's like, how is this group going to do this? Which is all right. The people behind you, the people behind him, the hostages, all that. And I imagine that also allows you to take a bit of the pressure away because it's not just me. It's about the team.
Yes. And in addition to that, Kelly, something I think you would certainly adhere to and second is the idea of focus. Mm-hmm. And one of our tenets is that if I dial in to this other person in such a way that I am solely focused on him and what he's enduring and what he's going through. See, that's the thing is that I can't focus on the hostages. If I focus on the hostage and the gun that's on them, I'm out of the game, yeah. Right? Because all I see is the problems. All I see is, you know, death. All I see is where I could mess up and people die if I focus on the gun. So I've got to focus on him. And I do so in for two reasons. One, it helps him, which is mm-hmm. good. And two, it's going to help me with my stress. Here's why. And you know this to be fact, Kelly. Whenever we so focus in on another human being's issues, someone close to us or somebody important or somebody that, you know, clearly is in dire need, when we do that in a deep way, phones are gone, you're not emailing, you're not doing anything else, just like you and I are right now. Mm-hmm. When we do that, the everything else will start to fall away. The sirens, the helicopters overhead, the squawking of the radio, the demands that are going back and forth, you know, for liaison, sound of engines, fire trucks, everything will fall away. And I'm just there talking to him about what's going on with him today. And that will automatically lower my anxiety, my stress level. And because all those great endorphins are kicking off in the brain, because it's telling you, hey, you're doing a good thing here. You're helping somebody through it. And it's also managing your own emotions and state.
I suspect that you can't be truly effective in this line of work if you are cynical. And I can't imagine being in this work for a long period of time and not becoming cynical.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's a good point. And I think one of the things is that helps you through that, and I certainly get your point, is that you're going to be dealing, and that's the thing, is that some people said, you know, when they got to a point in their life as an agent, they said, you know, I just got tired of people lying to me.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. That's interesting, yeah. Right? But for negotiations, you know, your ultimate goal is you're helping other people. That's what you're there for. This dude, yeah, put a red dot on his head, done, right? But hey, I don't want to give anybody that nightmare. I don't want anyone to be wrestling with their conscience. I don't want any possibility of mess up. The only way I do that is through words. So that's what helps, I think, kind of stabilize that perspective.
Yeah, I get it. I was, so my wife makes fun of me in terms of the fiction I read or the TV show. She's like, do they solve crimes? It's like Nazis and crimes I'm interested in. And I love spy stuff. Uh-huh. And you monitored the movements of Harold Nicholson. This is a notorious case. I mean, can you tell us about it? I know of it, but tell our audience a little bit about the case and what you observed.
Sure. Again, one of those things where I was a rookie agent, happened to be at the right place at the right time. They needed people on the squad. It was an espionage squad. And we knew there was a penetration, into the intelligence community. We didn't know where. So going through all kinds of, I mean, it's ridiculous amount of research that is involved in this. You know, you're going through, you're establishing matrices. You're working very closely with the CIA. You're doing all these things. Anyway, this guy, there were a number of cases open of possibilities, and we had on our squad this guy. So we're monitoring, we're doing all those things. We're doing all the, you know, research that needed to be done and, surveillances and so forth. And eventually we know this is him. This is the guy. This is our penetration. So again, somebody out of Hollywood casting. I mean, he was a highly decorated, Army Ranger. I mean, this guy was a patriot all about it. You know, he would be on a poster board for recruitment. Extremely smart, very good leader. And he taught this at Langley. So, but it became apparent, and we intercepted some of his transmissions and so forth. We knew it was him. So, but the day before the arrest, again, I'm just low on the totem pole, right? And I'm in a monitoring room, and it's like the size of a closet. You know, it's really small. It's dark, and I've got a video monitor, and I'm looking at it because we had a camera, and we were watching him at work. And here's how it went. Again, day before the arrest. So everybody's a little bit, you know, charged here. We're worried, you know, we got to watch this guy. So he's going about his day, you know, he's typing, he's on phone calls. He's, you know, he's regular, right? Regular. And about midway through his day, not lunch yet, he stops and he starts looking around his desk. He starts like pulling on wires. He's toggling things. He's lifting up his computer keyboard. He's like, and then I send a text out. I'm like, something's up. Just want you guys to be on alert. You know, he's looking around. He's like, he could be aware of surveillance. So then he stops that and he goes back to work. Da da da. He's typing. He has lunch, you know, in his office. Comes back. He's typing on calls, everything. And he stops again. And this time he gets under his desk, right? And I know what he's doing. Although I can't see it, I can only see, you know, him, his backside. And he's pulling on things. He's, mm-hmm. again, he's looking for something. Clearly, he's being surveillance conscious. So I tell them all, right? And at this point, on my second text out, now the room's filled up. You know, the head of the office, the big boss is in there. Everybody working on this case is in there. It's jam-packed. Yet you could hear a pin drop. We're holding our breath. And he stops and goes back to work. He stops again. And this is where everyone is having a heart attack. He pushes out from his desk, and he stands up on his chair. And we know that that camera is implanted right above him mm-hmm. in the ceiling. And I'm standing very close to the guy that installed that camera. And again, no one's breathing. And you know, because you can only see from his belt buckle up, right? You can't see up further than that. But you know what he's doing. He's pushing up tiles. He's looking. It's one of those drop ceilings. And we're like, it's over, right? I'm on the phone. I'm telling surveillance, look, if he leaves now, bumper lock him. We're gonna be there to, you know, pull him over. We're gonna arrest him on the scene. He stops. We're all braced. We're ready to go. And then he goes and picks up the phone and he's typing and he's joking again. And regular day, he stops work at his regular time, gets in his car again. We're there. We're around. Follow him home. He does that. Like, all right. Okay. Well, what's going on? Cause anybody with his experience, he's aware that we had surveillance in there. Next day is their rest day. We're at the airport. You know, it's one of those things, Kelly, where, you know, you got the guy sweeping and they got the earpiece in, right? And then you're like, but, and I'm, you know, I'm way, way, way in the back. So I don't want to give up anything. You know, I don't want to mess anything up. Everyone boards that plane. He was going on with his team from Langley. They were going over to, Switzerland for a meetup. And he was going, his purpose was to meet up with his Russian handlers over there, which we knew, which because we intercepted that communication. And we knew that he would have documents on him that he shouldn't have for this trip. So everyone boards that plane at that time, but him. He's like in the gift shop. He's rolling around, you know, picking up gum. And we're like, he's inked. He knows, you know, he's playing us now. He's not going to get on that plane. And as they give the last boarding call, Nicholson boards that plane. And we go on. There was a team that goes in to arrest him, pulls him off. We say, hey, we want to interview you. You know, we want to find out about, you know, what happened. He's saying, I'm not talking. We say, we're going to bring the capital charges against you. You're going to be facing the death penalty. He says, oh, I would like to talk. Like, okay, that eventually does loosen up a lot of people, right? When they know they could mm-hmm. face the needle. So we're debriefing him. And one of the things we ask him was, did you ever check for surveillance in your office space? Because of course I did. What do you, you know, it was an insult, right? It was clearly an insult. He goes, yeah, I checked. Of course I checked. He goes, but you guys didn't have anything. I know, I was very thorough. We just let that pass. You're like, you know, you did check. He goes, yeah, I checked, of course. And we're like, he didn't see the camera? This guy who has installed those cameras, who has directed it to be done, who knows what we would do, didn't see it. And we're like, why? Why do you miss this? And it comes down to this, is the only thing we could think of is that he was so fixated on what needed to happen that the fear in his brain blocked him from seeing that. Because if he sees it, his life is over. So he can't see that because it means he's done, he's arrested, he's going. In his mind, this has to work out for him. There's no other reason that he doesn't see that camera, none.
So, I mean, this ties to this idea around disinformation and conspiracy theory and all that, which is we are desperate to tell us a story of the world that makes sense.
Yes.
And really, if we really want to think about it, it doesn't exist. Because it can't account for randomness.
Oh.
It can't. And you know, and we've all had these things happen in our lives. We've had tragic things happen in our lives. It's like, it doesn't make sense. Of course it doesn't make sense. And again, you try to figure out ways that you can cope and do all these things. But at the end of the day, too, for our own selves, That's an incredibly hard thing to manage. And especially as you're talking about, it's also the curse of knowledge, right? It's also that thing of like, when you're so good at something and you've done it so many times, often you're just not going to see it.
That's true, right? That's a fact. But yeah.
I'm curious for you. So when did you end up leaving the FBI?
2017.
And why?
Well, I was eligible to retire, and I knew I always wanted to start a business. I just didn't know what I was going to do with it. And that's what, you know, when I met Adele Gambardella at this entrepreneurial dinner, you know, she's crisis communications PR, and she hears what I do, and she goes, you know, I think we have something here. Let's talk more. And we spent, you know, time talking about what I learned at Quantico, what I practice in the field as an agent, as a hostage negotiator. He goes, yeah, we got something here. This works. He goes, we're going to do a masterclass. We're going to have it in 3 months, and we're going to do it in New York City. I was like, okay, right. Mm-hmm. And because she's, you know, she's very astute. She's very business savvy. She's very smart. And boom, sold the thing out. Did it again in DC. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about that too is, again, you got reps in, right?
Yes.
So proof of concept, reps in, all that sort of thing too then. And it's not necessarily different work.
Yeah, right.
To the point of these barriers that we put up between our business lines are so artificial. When you really think about it, it's all about how humans want to be seen, how they want to connect, how important relationships are, all the science that's been handed down to us, and trying to apply it in the day-to-day, not even day-to-day, moment-to-moment ways we live our lives.
I like moment-to-moment.
We have moments. How many moments do we have? And I know, you know, Dan Pink and others have all those exercises, which is like, count how many weeks you have left. How many weeks do you possibly have left? And when you make that, when you figure out that that's maybe 150 or whatever, how many weeks, or, you know, 500 weeks, whatever you want to call it, you might change the way you live your moments to moments. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. I imagine you have one for us.
Oh yeah, it's easy, Kelly. Thank you. And so for me, look, I'm just a regular dude. You know, there is nothing special about me whatsoever. When I was in the FBI, I was always like perplexed. How am I here? Right? Mm-hmm. Because all these people around me were stars. I mean, they were so capable. I mean, you got lawyers, you've got Navy SEALs, you've got accountants, you've got PhDs and chemists, you've got attorneys, you know, it goes on and on. And then there's me. And they're like, Chip, what did you do? And I was like, well, I was a minister. And they're like, okay. They said, you must have been a hell of a minister. Yeah, you know? Yeah. And so I'm like, no, that's the thing. I'm just a regular guy. And I think, so for me, it's like doing this even, you know, writing the book. It's like, there are so many gifted people that I worked with that I learned so much from and deserve all the credit. So it was hard for me to put myself out there and say, yeah, I want to talk about my experience. I want to talk about things that I learned. So that was my yes and.
Oh, I love it. The book is called Convince Me: High Stakes Negotiation Tactics to Get Results in Any Business Situation. Chip Massey, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
million feet.
Survive.